Okay, so today's review session for the final exam. Let me check real quickly here. Let me quickly look at I can't bring it up. Okay, so let me check something real quick here. What I went back to check was I wanted to give you the precise date of the exam. So the final is going to be Monday at 10 a.m. in this room. So MS 445. And what I'm going to do today is go over a practice exam that's going to be really close to the actual exam. What I'll probably manage to do today is just get through the problems that cover that portion of the course that's already been covered on the first two exams. But the calculations done there are, of course, important in the last end of the course where we looked at determinants, eigenvectors, eigenvalues, and orthogonal decompositions. So it's worth reviewing carefully the material that was already covered on the first two exams anyway. One thing I want to stress, though, is that just like on the second exam, when I told you that we're going to be definitions are going to be on the exam, and you should state them precisely, so too on the final exam, it's going to be the same four definitions, because they're effectively the most important ideas of the course. These concepts of a subspace, a basis, linear independence, and what a linear transformation is. So let me step through these definitions to prepare for the final exam. Memorize the definitions as I'm about to write them now, and just be able to restate these on the final exam. Okay, so the first definition is, what is a subspace? We're looking, ever since the first exam, we've constantly been counting talking about subspaces, either as the solution set of a homogeneous linear system, the span of a set of vectors, maybe the kernel of a linear transformation. There's many ways that subspaces arise. The basic definition is that a subspace of a vector space V is, first of all, it's a subset, let's call it W, of the space where all your vectors live, such that, well, the idea throughout linear algebra is to make sure everything behaves well with respect to scalar multiplication and vector addition. In the context of a subspace, what we want is anytime you have a number, so a real number lambda, and a vector, W with an arrow over it indicating a vector, let's put it inside that subset. What we want is, for any number, any vector that lives inside the subset, we want the scalar multiple of that vector by lambda to stay inside that subset. So that's closure under scalar multiplication. And similarly, if we start off with two vectors
that begin in W, once we add them together as vectors, we'll get a new vector, and what we want require of it is that it's still inside that subset. So a subspace of a vector space V is a subset W such that whenever lambda is in R and W is in capital W, then the scalar multiple of little w by lambda stays inside the set. And if I add two vectors inside the that started off inside the set, their vector sum lies inside the set. So that's the definition of a subspace. Next definition is a basis. So a basis for a subspace is a set of vectors All right, now here, it's going to be a small set of vectors. Let me give you the intuitive idea, explain why we're interested in bases, but the definition is slightly different than what we're looking for. The definition is basically designed to be a test to make sure that a given list of vectors will actually do what we want a basis to do. What we want a basis to do is to provide us coordinates for all the vectors inside the subspace. If we think of these, the elements of W as a lower dimensional subspace of V, then we don't need, and say V is an n-dimensional subspace, we don't need all n coordinates of every vector in V to fill out a smaller dimensional subspace. The idea of a basis is that it gives us a minimal set of directions that's capable of reaching every point in the subspace and also capable of giving us good coordinates for those points. So here's the definition that really is a test to make sure that a given list of vectors is actually going to fulfill our need. So a basis for a subspace W is going to be a set of vectors, let's say W1 through WK. I'm going to use a different letter, V and up to VK, such that, well, first of all, we want to be able to reach every vector in the subspace W by taking linear combinations of these guys. So we want every W in W can be expressed as W equals, and here's the utility of the basis, some constant times that first basis vector, similar terms until we reach the last basis vector. We want to be able to write every vector inside our subspace in exactly this fashion. And moreover, the coefficients C1, C keys K must be unique. If we, what we actually want of these vectors V1 through VK, if there be the smallest set of vectors such that we can reach every point in our subspace by taking linear combinations of the given list. But if we have too many of these guys, then they're not going to be independent of one another, and there'll be multiple paths to a single point. So when you think of basis, a good example to keep in the back of your mind is the standard basis. Standard basis, say, for R3, the vector going in the x direction, the vector going the y direction, the vector going in the z direction. Those three directions allow you to reach any point in a three-dimensional space. If you had more than three vectors, then there will be multiple ways of writing down a vector in such an expansion. And if there are multiple ways, then the numbers C1 through CK are not going to determine a given W uniquely. These coefficients end up being the coordinates by which we specify individual vectors inside a subspace. Okay, so, but what I've written down, a set of vectors such that every vector can be expressed as a linear combination of vectors of those lists with unique coefficients, that's the definition of what a basis is. And it effectively gives you a test to make sure you have a basis. You have to make sure that when you choose a vector inside W, that it can only be written one way as a linear combination of the given list. Now, Separate from that is a notion of linear independence. It gives me an alternative way of, a simpler check for seeing that, in fact, I do have a basis. If I try to apply the definition directly, I have to check every vector inside W to make sure I can write it in only one way. But it turns out that it's sufficient to just check the zero vector inside W and make sure there's only one way of writing the zero vector. So we phrase that a little bit differently. We call that notion of linear independence. We say that if the only solution of, let's set up an equation, x1 times a vector v1 plus x2 times a vector v2 plus xk times a vector vk. Suppose we have a linear combination of vectors that sums to zero. If the only solution of this equation is that first coefficient has to equal zero, the second coefficient has to equal zero, and all the way up to the last component has to equal zero. So if we only have one solution of this, then the given list of vectors are linearly independent. Okay, and then the way that condition is used is that if you have a linearly independent set of vectors, then anytime you can express a vector in terms of a linear combination of linearly independent vectors, there's only one choice for such an expansion. And so rather than, if you want to test to see if a given list is a basis, rather than checking every vector inside W, it suffices to make sure that only the zero vector, just look at the zero vector and make sure there's only one solution of this equation, that a linear combination of your given list of vectors produces zero. If there's only one solution of this, then your vectors are linearly independent, and they will then provide a basis for any subspace that they generate. All right, then there's one last definition. This one concerns functions between two vector spaces. We say a linear transformation between two vector spaces, V and W, is a function that's going to take me from one vector space to the other, such that, well, here it's kind of analogous to that first definition. What we demand for our special class of functions is that they behave well with respect to our two fundamental vector operations. What we want is, with respect to scalar multiplication, if we start off with a number and we choose a vector inside our domain, then what we want is that t applied to the scalar multiple of v by lambda has to have the same value as the scalar multiple by lambda of the value of t at the point at the vector v. So that's compatibility with scalar multiplication. And we have a similar rule analogous to two up on problem one. If we start off with two vectors living in the domain of this function, what we want is that when I add the two vectors together and then apply the function, I get the same result as if I applied my function to the first vector and then delayed adding it to the second vector until after I applied the function to the second vector. All right. So those are the four definitions that are guaranteed to appear on the final exam. Memorize these definitions and just be prepared to write them down, and you'll have 20 points on the final exam. That should not be too hard, but shouldn't be too hard to accomplish, memorizing and being able to regurgitate the definition. But my hope is that having these definitions precisely on the exam, as you go through the rest of the exam and I ask you for a basis, you can always turn back, your exam to the first page and look at what your answer is going to look like, and maybe that will give you hints as to what you need to do. In particular for bases, I often, when I ask questions, find a basis, oftentimes I'm presented with answers like I'm given a subspace rather than given a basis as an answer. What we're looking for, if I'm asking you for a basis, it's probably just a small list of vectors that are capable of generating an entire subspace. All right, so the second question on the exam is another question that's not going to involve any calculation at all, but it's included on the final exam because it sort of tests you on your understanding of things. So in this problem two, you're not actually required to calculate anything. Rather, I just want you to sort of recognize what happens in the middle of the calculation and how you can interpret that. So this problem two is, it's concerned with this augmented matrices that you get when you try to solve a linear system. So let me remind you how we solve a linear system. So here we have a bunch of equations. Maybe I'll even step back from this. We might even have a bunch of equations. A1m, xm equals b1, a21, x1 plus similar terms, a2m, xm equal b2, say we have n equations and m unknowns, a n m xm equals bn. So here's a system of linear equations. So n equations and n unknowns. And the way we handle that is, first of all, we think of it as a matrix equation, and we construct from the coefficient matrix and the inhomogeneous term on the right-hand side, we construct an augmented matrix. The way we solve this system is we then row reduce this matrix first to its row echelon form. But that's not, that tells us, proceeding this far will tell us some qualitative properties of the solution of the original system, but it's not quite the solution yet. Once you get to row echelon form, you continue row reducing until you reach reduced row echelon form. And then once you reach reduced row echelon form, this is supposed to be the augmented matrix of the solution. And so the idea will then be to convert back to equations. And then finally express a solution vector as a point on the hyperplane. Now I'm going to do this, go through the steps of solving a linear system in problem three. What I'm going to point out is that problem two deals with this process, but what it's concentrating on is the form of this matrix in reduced row echelon form and the sort of information that you can tell about the original linear system just from looking at this matrix midway through the process of actually writing down the solution. What I want you to note for each of these is what kind of linear system did it come from, and are there solutions, and finally, what's the dimension of the solution set? How many free parameters will there be in the solution set? All that information we can extract from the row echelon form of the augmented matrix. That's what you're supposed to interpret each of these matrices as. So, for example, that first, might as well write directly on the slide here. This first augmented matrix, it's got a total of four rows, so the original linear system had to involve four equations. On the left-hand side is the coefficient matrix A, and each column of the coefficient matrix corresponds to a particular variable. since I have four columns, I must come from a system with four equations and four unknowns. So the number of equations is coming from the number of rows, and the number of unknowns is coming from the number of columns on the left-hand side. Here we also have four rows, so four equations, and we have four unknowns. And in C, we have still four equations because we have four rows, but now we have five columns on the right-hand side, so there'll be five unknowns. All right, so from the augmented matrix in row echelon form, I can ascertain properties of the original linear system that that came from. Then in the second part, which I'm to describe the solution space. And so the first thing I'm going to look for is, are there solutions? And let me look at B first. That augmented matrix corresponding to part B, if you look at that third row, it corresponds to a particular equation. What it says is that if you write it out, it says 0 times x1 plus 0 times x2 plus 0 times x3 has to equal the number 1. Well, that just means that 0 is equal to 1, which is a contradiction. So amongst the four equations that are implied by this augmented matrix, one of them is contradictory. It implies 0 is equal to 1. If one of the equations is contradictory, the whole set is contradictory. And so in part B, there's no solution. But, and that happens whenever you end up with a pivot in this last column. So all zeros on the left and a non-zero number on the right. If that occurs in a matrix in row echelon form, well, if that occurs anywhere in an augmented matrix, it means you have a contradictory equation amongst your equation set. All right, so no solution there. There's nothing left to be done in part B. But for problems A and C, that phenomenon doesn't occur. I never have a bunch of zeros and a non-zero number in the last column. So both A and C are going to have solutions. And in fact, so this has solution. And this one also has a solution. But now I can count the number of free parameters. The free parameters of a augmented matrix that has a solution is going to correspond to the variables corresponding to columns without pivots. So here I have a pivot, no pivot in the last two columns. So what we have is a solution with two free parameters. And those free parameters are going to be corresponding to the last two columns. So X3 and X4 will be your free parameters. And in the third problem, there's a column without a pivot, and there's a column without a pivot, but columns 2, 3, and 4 contain pivots. So those are going to mean that x1 and x5, those are the variables corresponding to those columns, they're going to be free. So in problem C, you have four equations, five unknown. It has a solution with two free parameters. The free parameters are, in this case, going to be x1 and x5. So, important thing to note in this example, just because I have zeros in this first column doesn't mean I ignore x1. If you write down equations for this matrix, you'll see that you have no equation involving x1. That doesn't mean you forget about it. It's still going to exist as a free parameter in your solution. It's just that you can adjust x1 arbitrarily because apparently no conditions at all are placed on that variable, so it will remain free. Okay, so the first page is purely formal, or interpretive. In the third problem on the practice exam, what I have for you to do is I'm going to ask you to look at a linear system and work its solution all the way to the point where you reach the hyperplane. So let's carry that out on for this given system of three equations and three unknowns. First, what we do is we form the augmented matrix by reading off the coefficients and the number on the right-hand side. So from the first equation, we have 0 times x1 minus 1 times x2 plus 2 times x3 is going to equal 0. Second equation, we have 2 times x1 minus 3 times x2. X3 does not appear, and that has to equal 2. And then we have 1 minus 1 minus 1, 1 coming from the third equation. All right, now, what we'll do next is we'll row reduce to row echelon form. Well, what we want are the pivots to occur in the staircase, but right now what we have are pivots below pivots, and in fact, pivots proceeding off to the left of pivots in the rows above it. So maybe the first thing I'll straighten out is I'll try to put a pivot up in this upper left-hand corner. So let's interchange row one and row three. That will produce one, minus one, minus one, one. And then second row is not changing. Third row is becoming the old row one. All right, now I've got a pivot in this upper left-hand corner, and I can use it to clear out entries below it, and then I'll get the matrix in row echelon form, at least up to the first row. So I guess the thing to do is to send row two to row two minus two times row one. I'm trying to get rid of this guy. And that's going to produce, well, 1 minus 1 minus 1, 1. First row is not changing under this operation, nor is the last row. But what happens to the second row is I have 2 minus 2 times 1 is 0. 3 minus 2 times negative 1 is going to end up being minus 1. And 0 minus 2 times negative 1 is going to be plus 2. And 2 minus 2 times 0 is going to be 0. Okay, good. Now we've got it in row echelon form up to the second row. We need to do send row 3 to row 3 minus row 2. We'll get 1 minus 1 minus 1, 1, 0 minus 1, 2, 0, and 0, 0, 0, 0, because in fact, the second row is exactly equal to the third row, and we'll get a zero row at the bottom of that matrix. And at this stage, we've reached row echelon form. We still have to go to reduced row echelon form before we start to convert back to equations. So what's wrong with this matrix? Why isn't it in row echelon form? Well, to be in reduced row echelon form, you need the pivots to equal 1. So I'm going to have to multiply the second row by negative 1 so that its pivot is 1 instead of minus 1. And then I also need to clear out the entries that sit above pivots. In the second, this pivot here, there's an entry above it. I'll need to clear that out. So what we do next is we send row 2 to its negative. That will fix, that will renormalize that constant. And I'll send row 3 to, I'll send row 1 to row 1 minus row 2 so that I can clear out this entry in the 1, 2 slot. And that then going to produce a matrix 1. Okay, so when I subtract the second row from the first, I'll get 0. Negative 1 minus 2 is going to be negative 3. And 1 minus 0 is going to equal 1. second row, we have 0. Now I'm also going to take this second row and I'll multiply it by minus 1. Minus 2, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. All right, now I've reached the matrix in reduced row echelon form. It's in row echelon form. There are the pivots. All pivots are equal to 1, and above and below pivots, I have nothing but zeros. Good. So the matrix in reduced row echelon form is the augmented matrix of the solution. So let's write down the solution equations. The first row says that x1 minus 3x3 is equal to 1. Second row says that x2 minus 2x3 is equal to 0. And the third row doesn't tell us much. It just says 0 is equal to 0 when I convert the augmented matrix back into equations. There's one more thing we want to do with this matrix in reduced row echelon form is to decide which variables are independent, which variables are fixed by the equations, and which we are going to be left over and regarded as free variables. The rule we use is we take the variables corresponding to columns without pivots, we interpret those as free variables. So in this set of equations, x3 is going to be a free variable. I'm going to put it on the opposite side of the equation. And so what we'll get is x1 is equal to 1 minus 1 plus 3x3. It'll flip signs as I move it to the opposite side of the equation. X2 is going to equal 2x3. And now I'm finally in a position to write down a solution vector. It would have, without any restrictions on the variables, it would just have three components. But I'm demanding that this vector actually satisfy the original linear system. And that means that x1 can be must be expressible in terms of x3 as 1 plus 3x3. Second variable can be expressed in terms of the free variable x3, as can x3 itself. Then the last step is to expand this vector solution in terms of the free variable. So we have a constant vector coming from the constants in each component. And then we're going to have terms that are proportional to x3. In the first component, it's that 3. The second component, it's 2. And the last component, it's 1 times x3. Okay, and now I've got the hyperplane expression for the solution of the original linear system. Any solution vector can be achieved by starting at the point 1, 0, 0, and then straying from that point along the direction of the vector 3, 2, 1 by an arbitrary amount. This is a free parameter, so it's allowed to be any real number. So that's actually a hyperplane. More generally, a hyperplane is a set of vectors that you construct by taking a given starting point and then straying from that starting point in as many directions as you want, but in this example, k directions, and then you allow these coefficients to range over the entire real line. That's what a hyperplane is. It's basically a flat surface embedded in a higher dimensional space with, in this instance, k directions from which we can stray from an initial starting point. This expression has exactly that form. In fact, it's a line. A line is a special case of a hyperplane. It's where you start at a point and you head off in only one direction from that point. Okay, so our solution is a line, i.e. a one-dimensional hyperplane. Okay, so that's really kind of crucial calculation that we've done over and over in this course. Oftentimes, I did this in the case of a hand, I did this for an non-homogeneous system of equations where somewhere on the right-hand side I had some non-zero numbers. But you follow the same procedure even when you have a homogeneous system. It just simplifies a little bit. So a similar calculation for what we call homogeneous linear systems. That's where we have AX is equal to the zero vector. In this case, you basically follow the same procedure, but nothing ever happens in this last column. So we tend to just work with the row reduce the matrix A rather than the augmented matrix A with the zero vector adjoined to it. So, and in fact, we do this calculation a lot because the solution set of this is completely characterized by the matrix, and we call it the null space of the matrix. Okay, so that's an aside, but okay, so let's move on to a next problem. In this fourth problem, you're asked to compute the inverse of a matrix. There's two ways of doing this. One is to compute the cofactor matrix of A, take its transpose, and then divide that by the determinant. But I don't think I'm going to give you an example where that method needs to be applied. We can also find inverses of matrices simply by doing row reduction. So let me show you how that works in this case. What you do is you form, you take the given matrix and you adjoin to it the identity matrix of the same size. And then you row reduce all the way to reduced row echelon form. And one of two things is going to happen. Either you get a matrix where on the left-hand side you get the identity matrix, and if that happens, on the right-hand side you'll get the desired inverse. Or you're going to get something else in that left-hand side, and in which case it doesn't make any difference. There's no inverse. In other words, when you row reduce this matrix and you get something other than the identity matrix on the left, that means that the inverse of the original matrix does not exist. Usually the way this will happen is you'll look at the bottom of that matrix and you'll see a zero row, and the identity matrix does not contain a zero row. Okay, so let's work it out for this particular problem. We'll start with 210, 100, minus 201, and I'll join to that the 3x3 identity matrix. All right, so maybe the first thing we'll do to get the row reduction going is to, I like pivots when they're already equal to one. So first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to interchange row one and two. Zero, and then I'll have 010, 100, 210, minus 201001. All right, so all I did in this first step of row reduction is I wanted to get a convenient pivot up in this corner, so I interchanged two rows. All right. Now, now what I can do is I can use this pivot in the upper corner here to clear out entries below it. So I can send row two to row two minus two times row one, and I'll send row three to row three plus two times row one. And what will come out of that will be 100010. 2 minus 2 is 0, 1 minus 2 times 0 is 1, 0 minus 2 times 0 is 0, 1 minus 2 times 0 is 1, 0 minus 2 times 1 is minus 2, and 0 minus 2, that would be 0. And what will happen to the third row is I'll get 0, 0 minus 0 is 0, 1 minus 2 times 0 is 1. And then what happens here is we get 0, negative 2, positive 2. I'm taking 2 times, positive 2 times the first row, and I'm adding it to the third row, and then I'll get 1. All right, so what happened here? During this row reduction, I've converted this matrix into a matrix of this form. Here's the 3x3 identity matrix. That means that I can identify the right-hand side as A the minus first. So all we have to do to finish the problem is simply write A the minus first is 0, 1, 0, 1, minus 2, 0, 0, 2, 1. And that's your answer. Okay, so it's if you know the algorithm, then it's just a row reduction calculation. And like this example, I'll try to design the problems on the exam so that the row reduction is fairly straightforward and fast. All right, so problem 5 is a problem where you're given Problem 5, you're given a set of vectors, a set of three-dimensional vectors, and you're asked to determine if it's a subspace or not. Well, what does that mean? Well, what we're looking for is a set of vectors such that it's closed under scalar multiplication and closed under vector addition. So let's look at that set and try to decide if it's closed under, for example, is W closed under scalar multiplication? If it's not, then it cannot be a subspace. So let's choose a number 0. Let's choose a vector W equal, I want it to sit inside this set, but it's pretty easy to see that this vector 1, 0, 0, when I add its components, I get the number 1. So the three components of this vector, they add up to 1. That means W is inside this set. What I want to check is to make sure that the scalar multiplication of that element of the set by the number 0 still lives inside that set. So when we do lambda times W, well, of course, anytime you scalar multiply by 0, you're just going to get the 0 vector as a result. But now 0 plus 0 plus 0, when I add up the components of this vector, I get 0, and that does not equal 1. So this vector, lambda times W, doesn't satisfy this condition to be a member of capital W. And so it's not closed under scalar multiplication, and so it's not a subspace. All right, and that's the answer. But there's another way you could have shown that it's not a subspace. The definition of subspace requires it to be closed under both scalar multiplication and vector addition. So alternatively, what you could have done is you, instead of choosing a number and a vector and making sure scalar multiplication is closed, choose two vectors. W1, let's set it equal to 1, 0, 0, and W2, set it equal to 0, 1, 0. So in both cases, 1 plus 0 plus 0 equals 1, so it lies inside W, and here we have 0 plus 1 plus 0 equals 1, so it also lies, both these vectors live inside the given set. The question is, does their vector sum live inside that set? Well, that would be 1, 0, 0 plus 0, 1, 0 equals 1, 1, 0. But now, when I add the components of this vector, 1 plus 1 plus 0, I get 2, not the value 1 that I need in order to live inside this set. And so it's not in W, and so it's W is not closed under vector addition, and so it's not a subspace. Okay, so it's you. So on the final exam, I mean, I had a question in my first lecture. Oh, what if it was a subspace? Would you do the same thing? And so I'm sorry to say that if it is a subspace, it's harder to actually justify that, because you have to show that both, that it's closed under scalar multiplication, no matter how you choose a vector W, and you must show that it's closed under vector addition, no matter how you choose vectors D1 and W1 and W2. It's easier to disprove than it is to prove. And so probably what I'll do on the final exam is give you a subspace and ask you to effectively to show that it's not a subspace by showing that it's not closed under scalar multiplication, or that it's not closed under vector addition. Okay, so, and in my solutions here, I gave you two answers. You could either show that it's not closed under vector addition and deduce that it's not a subspace, or you can show that it's not closed under scalar multiplication and therefore not a subspace. You don't have to prove both. All right, let's see. Problem six. Problem six deals with linear independence, but be aware, for these kind of problems, you're not actually going to use the definition of linear independence. Rather, you're going to use this test for linear independence that we've been employing. Basically, we answer this question by doing a quick row reduction. So what we'll do in this, for this example, to determine if these vectors are linearly independent, well, basically what you want to do is make sure there's no way of adding these vectors together and producing the zero vector without taking all the coefficients separately equal to zero. But I won't do that directly. What I'm going to do instead is I'm going to form a matrix using the given list of vectors as rows. So 1, minus 2, 2, 1. 1, minus 1, 3, 1. 0, 1, 1, 0. And 2, minus 3, 5, 2. And I'm going to row reduce. And that's, I'll take it, let's see, my solutions, I think I go all the way to reducial echelon form. Probably only have to go to row echelon form. So that matrix row reduces to 1, 0, 4, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. And then I have two zero rows at the bottom of that matrix. Now, this row reduction actually shows that the original set of vectors were not linearly independent. This row reduction process, what do you do? Well, for the most part, you don't do much. You either just change the order of the rows, or you multiply a row by a scalar factor. The operation you use most often is you take a row and you replace it by its sum with a multiple of another row. And when you do this operation over and over again, what you do is you replace rows by linear combinations of your given list of rows. So if you start off with a given list of vectors and you're row reducing, each of these rows is basically a linear combination of the four vectors that you started off with. It's just that you manipulated them over and over again, but you're still just taking linear combinations like so of the original rows. And what's happened here is that you found some linear combination of the original rows that will produce a zero row. And you've also found, in fact, you've found two different linear combinations probably that produce zero rows. And so there's got to be a way of taking these four vectors, summing them up in a linear combination and producing a zero row. Well, that means that the original rows, if you see these zero rows appearing in the row reduction, that means that the original vectors were not linearly independent, because there were some linear combination of these guys that produce a zero row. So in this case, the non-zero rows, or sorry, the zero rows indicate the original vectors are not linearly independent. All right, and that answers part A. Part B, the span of these vectors is just the row space of this matrix. And what I've calculated here, if you remember how we find a basis for the row space, is we row reduce the matrix and we grab the non-zero rows. So in fact, the set of all possible linear combinations of these four vectors, well, they can be, that set can be generated by just these two vectors. And these vectors are linearly independent because I won't be able to cancel the first component unless I set, well, if I try to take a linear combination of the first row with the second row, I cannot produce zero without taking the first coefficient equal to zero, because I can't cancel it with something there, and nor can I cancel the second component without taking the multiple of the second row equal to zero. So these two are two vectors that are linearly independent, and they generate the entire space that's generated by the original four vectors. That means this subspace is two-dimensional because it has two basis vectors. And so the answer there is, because you have two non-zero rows, means that the row space of that matrix A is two-dimensional. And that in turn, is it really 12:30 already? Oh, I'm sorry. Have I run away? Anyway, this is probably more than halfway through the exam. I'm sorry, I ran 4 minutes over. At any rate, because you have two non-zero rows, the row space is two-dimensional, and that's equal to the span of the original vectors. Okay, so on Friday, what I'll do is I'll finish up the rest of this practice exam.